Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dharma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from August 1st, 2017. My Dharma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Brahma Viharas. The Brahma Viharas are perfected mind states that reflect an enlightened view of humanity and development of the Eightfold Path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. The Brahma Viharas. The Brahma Viharas are four sublime mind states. They're four sublime mind states that are. They're qualities of mind to be mindful of as aspects of awakening. The reason why I'm saying it that way is they're not. Oftentimes these concepts of love and compassion, they're used as to mask wrong or ignorant views, as opposed to developing the Eightfold Path and then becoming an expression of an awakened human being. So let me read the article. There are four sublime states of mind that are taught by the Buddha. These are perfected mind states that reflect an enlightened view of humanity. In Pali, these states are known as the Brahma Viharas, or perfected abodes, meaning the abode, meaning that they're qualities of mind that we actually reside in. They're ongoing. And again, they're an expression of an enlightened and awakened mind. These are mind states that one abides in. These states of mind animate conduct to all human beings. In other words, if we're living in these mind states, that will direct how we interact with the world around us. Consequently, if we're not, it will also direct that too. I got into an interesting discussion with someone. I can't remember where it was. But how this underlying competitiveness for the need to continue to establish a self ultimately leads to all the aggression that we have in the world and all the problems that we have in the world. If we would simply recognize that, and it's not likely to occur anytime soon, but if we would all recognize that on a global scale, there'd be no more strife in the world because there'd be no more competition within ourselves and outside of ourselves. And that's what I mean by that last line. These are also the wise and loving response to all social interaction and will diffuse tension and conflict. The four sublime states of mind as taught in the Dhamma are love or loving kindness, or metta, compassion, the Pali word for that is karuna, unselfish joy or mudita, and equanimity, upekkha. A teaching of the Buddha on these four sublime states is found throughout the Pali Canon, and here is a teaching on all four states from the Digha Nikaya, the Buddha's words. Friends, when one dwells continuously with their heart filled with loving kindness, pervading the entire world, they are abundant, they have grown great, their love is measureless, and they are free from enmity and distress. Friends, when one dwells continuously with their heart filled with compassion, pervading the entire world, they are abundant, they have grown great, their love is measureless, and they are free from enmity and distress. Friends, when one dwells continuously with their heart filled with unselfish joy, pervading the entire world, they are abundant, they have grown great, their love is measureless, and they are free from enmity and distress. Friends, when one dwells continuously with their heart filled with equanimity, pervading the entire world, they are abundant, they have grown great, their love is measureless, and they are free from enmity and distress. My words, love is always selfless and imbued with dana, generosity. Love embraces all things in the phenomenal world while being mindful of impermanence. Love does not further clinging. Love does not discriminate. With no eye, there is no mind of discrimination. Love is dispassionate, seeing all things with equanimity. Finally, love is the Dhamma, and living in and expressing the Dhamma. I remember our second retreat. You might remember this too, Bob, because you were there. I think it was Saturday afternoon, and one of the attendees who engages in bhakti yoga, devotional yoga, was getting quite agitated. And her question finally was, where is the love? Where does the Buddha teach love? And he doesn't teach it in a direct way except as a quality of mind to develop through the Dhamma. In other words, the most loving thing we can do for all humanity is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. Developing the Dhamma is an act of love. It's an act of compassion for all human beings. And that's how the Buddha teaches it.
I still find the use of the word love confusing.
Because of all the different connotations that
it has. Because of, in general usage, there are so many connotations that anybody can make, you know, put whatever they want. But then I see that towards the end of each paragraph, the Buddha himself uses it.
Well, and it's a translation.
Does he speak of metta here?
Yes.
Okay, he uses the word metta at the end of, you know, where it says his love is measureless.
Yes, I could have used the word metta.
Okay.
Every place where I'm using love. And that's really the reason why I'm not, is to make that point, that the type of love that we're talking about in the Dhamma is an open heart that's full of goodwill for everyone. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with clinging, or obviously it has nothing to do with romantic love, which really isn't love, I mean, except it's a common usage. It's an open and generous heart with no discrimination, is really what metta is, isn't it? Goodwill towards all, beginning with ourselves. You know, again, there's that expression that I use, the most loving thing I can do for myself and for all sentient beings is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. It's that type of love. But again, the Buddha never taught anything that would relate to the common usage of love, and the meaning romantic love or that type of thing. It just doesn't relate in any way to the Buddha's teaching, because that's stuck in a clinging, self-referential view, isn't it? But it is. It's confusing. So when I'm using the word love, I'm really meaning metta. And I think I promised in a couple of weeks I'm going to give a talk on the Karaniya Metta Sutta and how that came about, because the backstory to that is really interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe next week, we'll see. Let me continue. Compassion arises from understanding our own suffering. Through Dhamma practice, an understanding of confusion and suffering occurs. Through personal understanding comes universal understanding. Compassion deepens for ourselves and others through right understanding or right view. This develops compassion informed by wisdom. Compassion is also free of discrimination and passion. Compassion to all beings begins with remaining harmless. Compassion to all beings is maintaining right intention. That line, compassion to all beings begins with remaining harmless, means that in order to practice true compassion, we have to marry it with wisdom. It has to be informed by wisdom. Often, well-intentioned compassion can be harmless to some people if it doesn't have wisdom behind it. I don't want to get into descriptions of that right now, but if that's a question, I'll get into it later. Unselfish joy is pure joy with others' success and happiness. It is joy that seeks to further others' happiness without passion or discrimination. The highest aspect of unselfish joy is the joy that comes from recognizing another's understanding of the Dhamma. And that's the most important aspect of Dana. It's the most important aspect of a lack of ignorance, is sharing the Dhamma with others in an unselfish way. And then taking joy, I'm lucky I have the seat, in seeing other people developing the Dhamma. That's the highest type of joy, the highest type of compassion. The highest form of dana is to express the true Dhamma. The Buddha lived his entire life in that mind state of great generosity.
Where does generosity fit in the realm of viharas? It's not one of the great questions.
It's an ongoing expression of each and every one of them if you look at it closely. You know, especially this part of unselfish joy, and taking that. When I read about the life of the Buddha and how he interacted with people, what I see is the most meaningful life I've ever read about, because of how meaningful it was, because of what he was. Imagine how he must have felt, because he knew what he was teaching, you know, and he saw the effect on people from his very first teaching. He saw people awakening. You know, Kandana did it. Bonnie.
So that's what's referred to as the unselfish joy?
That's an aspect of it.
Give an example. I know that seems rather...
It's important. In a general way, taking joy in seeing someone else's success, just in a general way. You know, they might pick one. You know, they get a raise at work or something like that, or they find that they're going to have a baby or anything like that. To have true joy about that, and not in any way feel like, gee, I wish it was me. You know, that I'm making, that's underlying that. That's true upekkha. But the highest expression of that is to take joy in other people in recognizing the understanding in other people is developing. Because what's more valuable, what's more important?
Their freedom from suffering and its causes. That's the highest. So, like you said, the mundane is success, like mundane success. But that we know is impermanent, it's fleeting, it has its own poisons. But to see somebody who's truly practicing from a place of equanimity and awareness and mindfulness, that we can take true joy in that.
Because we know it's the most. It's that again encompasses all four of these exalted mind states. Where was I? Equanimity. Equanimity is a mind that is free of reaction, stable in its understanding of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, the three marks of existence. A mind resting in equanimity is a mind deeply mindful of all that is occurring, and a mind that responds with wisdom, love, and compassion in all situations. A mind of equanimity is a mind free of an attachment to an ego personality, and is free of defending or maintaining the ego self. Equanimity is a mind of lasting peace and happiness. These are mind states free of discrimination. In this manner, they are also referred to as boundless states, as they are not limited by any partiality. These qualities of mind are effortlessly maintained in all situations. They are the results of a wholehearted Dhamma practice that has a recognition of views arisen from a lack of understanding, and has achieved a measure of non-reaction or equanimity. The framework for Dhamma practice is the Eightfold Path, and that provides the right view necessary to gain mindfulness of these perfected mind states and recognition when one is not abiding in them. And that's one of the most important aspects of this of these teachings, to recognize when we're not abiding, when we're not expressing these mind states. And in a way, to not be judgmental of ourselves in any way, but simply recognize that we're outside of the framework of the Eightfold Path in that moment. Remember how the Buddha teaches and how I teach to be mindful of each factor of the Eightfold Path. So when we're when we might be a little stingy and not taking great joy in other people's achievements and success, to recognize that that's an aspect of a self-centered view, that there's selfing involved in that, and to simply abandon it in that moment. When we're not acting with metta, with true love towards all beings, to simply recognize it. You know, these are taught as to provide direction to our Dhamma practice in the way to be mindful of them when we're not expressing it, but also, as importantly, when we are engaged in reflecting these exalted mind states, to be mindful of that also. Because it's important to recognize as we're developing the Dhamma, isn't it? Let me continue. In this way, mindfulness of the state or condition of one's mind as in the present moment provides a direction for ongoing Dhamma practice. This is another practical aspect of non-analytical insight. Simply recognize it when you're either in it or out of it. Samatha Vipassana meditation brings insight to all clinging and impermanent views arising from a lack of understanding. As meditation practice develops within the framework of the Eightfold Path, mind states that are less than loving or compassionate or lacking unselfish joy or equanimity become apparent. Putting aside the need to defend views of an ego self allows for recognition of these sublime states and the right intention to renounce clinging to wrong views. The entire Dhamma develops these four sublime states of mind. The love that is developed is not a reaction to passion or possessive of an object. Compassion is also dispassionate and informed with wisdom. Being free of attachments allows for true joy in others' accomplishments. A mind of equanimity is always mindfully present and unwavering in love, compassion, and unselfish joy. In this way, the Dhamma is a Dhamma of developing perfect love, and perfect love has aspects of all four sublime states of mind. Getting back to Ram's confusion with the word love, substitute metta. You know, the way that metta is goodwill. Metta is dana. It's ongoing expression of dana. The only way we can truly be generous is to truly be in that mind state of metta. Or maybe I should say all four sublime mind states. You know, and then there's no me in the generosity. The highest expression of an awakened human being is ongoing dana with the Dhamma. But that doesn't mean that that an awakened human being is always on a street corner preaching the good news. An awakened human being is living their life as an expression of that awakened human being. There's no need to evangelize it. You're an expression of it. It's interesting when you read the Pali Canon. That's how the Buddha taught. His very first teaching was based on the attraction that his five buddies had towards him for the way he was holding himself. He didn't beat them over the head with the Dhamma. They saw it within him and they sought it out. In that way, these four sublime mind states encompass that quality of being, of love, compassion, generosity, a mind resting in equanimity, a calm mind. So that's today's talk. Thank you. Any questions before we go around the room? Ram. Hmm.
Well, meditation's going good. Practice is going good. Working my way through the book.
Good.
Yeah, and I keep looking at it in practice too. More and more keep running into situations where it's getting to be appropriate to explain to them or see where part of it can fit and can be of help.
Yeah.
Can you say that again, Rob?
More and more running into situations where it's appropriate to teach the Dhamma, or teach my understanding. And it's, you know, as I know from other studies, it's not until you start explaining it. Of course, you have to explain it to yourself. But when you start explaining it to somebody else, it's when that's the true test of understanding. Mm-hmm.
It also shows the development of that quality of mind that's able to do that. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, 4 years ago, you couldn't do it simply
right.
Because you hadn't developed an understanding of it.
Right. And I was also missing part of the compassion and loving kindness.
Yeah.
That's also just necessary for it.
Yeah. True compassion.
Yeah. Some of these people they require quite a bit of compassion to deal with. But as compassion develops, it actually becomes easier to deal with difficult people, because you see how they just create their own suffering.
Yeah.
And you look at it and say, God, all that misery.
Yeah.
Maybe I can a little bit of dynamite in there, see if that, that can help. Just, you know, take the edge off their suffering. There's a lot of suffering out there.
Yeah. Remember the Nagara Sutta, the Buddha looked around. He saw the flames of passion all around him in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he was describing, that suffering. But it takes, again, great understanding and great compassion to not judge the suffering and simply recognize it as the first noble truth. You know, it's out there. What do we do with it? It also takes kshanti. It takes patient forbearance and to stay with it, be present with it. It takes a developed dhamma. Thanks for sharing that with us. Jen, good to see you tonight. How are you? And you're seeing where concentration is the foundation of all of that. You have to have a well concentrated
job.
Yeah.
All the time. You have to, I mean, I've been trying to do it just always being present with it. Observe. Thank you.
Keith, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you.
Could you put the air conditioning?
You're welcome.
I notice it doesn't take long if I start not maintaining my practice before my concentration is noticeably different. And then it only takes a few days of getting back on track before I notice it. Everything calms down and I, you know, become a lot more focused.
Yeah.
So my practice is going well right now, and that's about all I have.
Thank you. Glad you're here. I got a great question from a student a couple months ago. And he said, why did the Buddha keep meditating after he awakened? Why wouldn't he? It's an ongoing process. Everything is in a process. Even an awakened human being is in a process. Glad you're here. Maura, good to see you.
I'm good to be here. And I came in late as usual. And I felt when I sat down such a strong current in here that it feels like a stream, you know. You can come like in and whoop. In terms of, not to get all woo-woo, but it's very easy to sit down in here and the mind immediately kind of pulls into concentration and flow, whatever. So thank you everybody for holding into space. It's funny because when I was talking to you earlier and coming said it was the noble and the ignoble search.
Oh, that's Thursday.
Yeah. And I had seen it flip by about the Brahma Viharas, but I just let it go. Instead of saying something. But, so anyway, I was surprised that was a topic. And I have really been working with a strong, heartfelt meta, tender, open, boundless heart state just to kind of, you know, I'll do the first 10 minutes of my concentration practice, just working in that space. And then, but staying concentrated, you know, noticing the same thing, mindful when I'm out, you know, in thought. Just, so it's a kind of a concentration practice, right? So I've really been the past couple, well, maybe the past 2 weeks, has been a real focus of mine is recognizing when those mind states are present or abandoning when they're not. So not to get into a big question, because I think I'll save it for a different time, but you had said something, and this can go back years too, that those aspects of mind, metta, karuna, upekkha, and mudita, are the expression of an enlightened mind, right? They're just there. And you said tonight, like, you don't practice them, because there can be, like, a spiritual bypassing that can go on, right?
Easy.
Yeah, right? So I was like, you know, because I will look when that mind state is, if the opposite is present. So somebody does something, and from a self-centered perspective, I don't like it. Like, they didn't, they changed their plans or something, right? But then, like, right away, I'll switch it to, I recognize disappointment or a feeling or something, and then we'll say, well, they're doing what they think is, like, just like the felt sense of wishing their good well, like wanting them to be happy no matter what it is, and supporting that if it's not harmful. But anyway, and that just feels very energizing. And so then I started thinking, well, was that bypassing?
There's one way to know that you're not engaging in, to use that modern term, spiritual bypassing, or, you know, spiritual bypassing is just another term for continued ignorance, ignoring what's in front of you. The only way, well, maybe I shouldn't put that absolute on it, the only way that I know of to assure against continued ignorance is the Eightfold Path. That's why the Buddha taught it. So if our thoughts, words, and deeds are framed by the Eightfold Path, then we know that we're not engaged in spiritual bypassing or ignoring what's in front of us. Again, that's why the Buddha taught it. So we can easily get caught up in... it's one of the problems, and this is not... I'm saying that you are. Are we air conditioning back on? It's an important question, because it happens all the time. And again, that's why the Buddha taught these not as something to use in a conceptual way, to use it as an expression, in fact, an acknowledgement of ongoing development of the Eightfold Path.
Right, acknowledgement. But yeah. I think the way that I use it is within the context of the Eightfold Path. So when I have an instant like that, I recognize I'm clinging to a self. So I'm abandoning craving. There's a sense of open-heartedness, because I do really, like, I feel like the most important thing that I can do in my life is transform my mind, take to the Dhamma, practice for my own well-being and the well-being of everybody else in my life. So there's an energizing, open-hearted, non-selfing felt sense about that. So I'm certainly, like, not enlightened, but I kind of including. So tonight I was having a lot of pain initially in my neck, and just like staying with the concentration of allowing and just noticing and bringing a softness of, like, but not a conceptual, just like including, like, a sense of boundlessness. And feeling joyful about it.
And
at the end of the meditation, my body felt fine. I was enlivened, and I stayed concentrated. So
sounds pretty good to me.
That I would say is, I've been thinking a lot about the Buddha lately in terms of the four immeasurables or whatever you call it, like he or compassion, right? So he, generosity, you brought up Dana. The Buddha left his palace, his home, his family, his kids, in order to pierce suffering for everyone, like, so that act in and of itself was a selfless act.
It was a selfless act, but you could, it depends on how you're looking at it, because you bring up a point. The Buddha described his life in the palace as a confining place, so you could argue, well, wasn't it selfish for him to leave? We're getting into an analytical way of looking at, we're looking at the Buddha's life in a way that we might reflect it on ourselves. So, of course, it was with great compassion that he left the confining place. It's the same thing that we do in Dhamma practice. We can't get too, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but you're bringing up an important point. If we're using the framework of the Eightfold Path, we don't have to get too deep into our motivations, because as the Buddha teaches, when you are engaged in wrong view, be mindful of that and to remain in right view. When you engage in wrong action, be mindful of that. Simply use the Eightfold Path as the framework for where you are. If there's an agitation at all in our minds in any way, it's not that we're doing something wrong. It's that if we're engaged in the Dhamma appropriately, that's something that we're saying, wait a minute, I need to look at my part in this. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. And just simply let it go. So you're bringing up a point that you notice selfishness in others momentarily, and you come back to compassion because you understand the suffering of others. I thought you brought that up. I thought you mentioned that. Okay. Well, the point is that we can avoid.
Oh no! I said if somebody makes a choice and it wasn't what I wanted, then that's not. They're not being selfish. They're just being themselves. And I can take it personally because it's not what I wanted. So I'm attached to an outcome of a self.
Yep.
Right? So just saying, they're doing what they, you know, it's just occurring. It doesn't have to have a label, good or bad, or, you know, I mean, not good or bad. I can wish, like, I'm happiness.
Yeah.
Yeah, and abandon my clinging and continue to just take to whatever is occurring.
Yeah. And...
But can we go back to the Buddha thing real quickly?
What about it?
And maybe we'll table the discussion, but I understand your point, but when the mythological story of seeing old age, sickness, and death, and, you know, I mean, him, you know, mythologically or metaphorically, maybe he did or didn't, you know, want the marks of existence and wanting to, you know, go out and find a way to end that. There must be a way out of that process.
Yeah.
But the whole reason that he even made those first steps out of the palace where he saw, you know, the sick man and the corpse and all that, at that point, I don't think he was...
And he didn't go out.
That didn't happen out of compassion. That happened out of his own suffering.
Yeah, no, I don't think that happened out of compassion, but when he saw those things and he realized that was the end for all of us, he had a motivation to figure out what is the way of, this is ridiculous, this life.
Because he also
it's all going to end up like that.
So we
need to find some answer to this satisfying nature of life.
Yep.
So I don't know that he just did one for himself. Like, to me, it seems like that's a grand question. It wasn't that he just wanted to find his own way out of suffering. I think he wanted... Maybe I'm wrong. Okay, so I'll just leave it.
Yeah.
It's getting a little speculative what he thought. The only way we can know really what the Buddha thought... I mean, the best way to know is to read the Nagara Sutta and how he describes his own awakening and his own process of seeing the suffering in the world and being caught in the feedback loop of self-referential views.
Right. Well, that was after that was describing his awakening. That wasn't describing that brought him to seek awakening.
Well, so all that we know is that he encountered sickness, aging, and death. It motivated him to seek a solution, whether it was a completely altruistic view or motivation, or it was completely self-centered, which I'm not saying it was, is only speculation. But again, we go back to the Buddha's words. He talked of himself before he awakened, which means talking about himself at that point where he decided that he's going to seek awakening as an unawakened bodhisattva. So he's acknowledging that he was a human being with great compassion, but he was ignorant of the true nature of the world. And so you can say that it was his acknowledgement of ignorance that initiated his search for knowledge. And that's exactly how he describes awakening. That's how he describes the common human problem as ignorance too.
Okay.
And so the solution is understanding.
Right. I understand that part. I get that.
Okay. So.
All right. That's good. We're good. We're good. We're good.
Great. Thank you. Frank, good to see you tonight. How are you? Welcome back.
Good to be here tonight. Thank you. Good to see everybody. Meditation's going great. And a six week vacation. And I'm looking forward to getting back to some normalcy. Spent some time away in faraway lands with strange people. And the world is aflame with people running and chasing after happiness and material possessions. Yeah. And a phenomenal world, like you talk. And, I like to keep things simple. And, I can see so much better when I take the intellect out of it and I look with my heart,
yeah,
the eyes of the heart. And, I think that the Buddha lays out a method of living life in a very simple, fashion. And practicing basic human spiritual principles like compassion, I like to put the word unconditional in front of all those principles, because then it takes the I out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, unconditional gratitude, humility, all that stuff breathes right into, an acceptance and surrendering my own will into the Dhamma helps me practice this method so much easier when I can be generous of my heart and not giving things, but giving of love and compassion and patience and tolerance and all those things that go with it. Has a completely different outcome when you're dealing with human beings.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
Other human beings can appreciate your patience and tolerance and your genuine love and not wanting anything in return. Other than just their happiness. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, just going to keep it simple.
It's always appreciated, Frank. Thank you.
And that's what I was trying to say. And I don't want to overanalyze it. Like, I know what works for me that creates a sense of well-being and other, like, not self-centeredness.
Liz, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you too. It's good to be here. Lately, I find myself still getting caught up in the activity of defending myself. So I think that's one of the hardest things that I have to keep bringing it back into the context of the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
Because it's such a conditioned reaction. So that's my struggle this week.
Thank you for sharing it with us. That the great freedom that comes from integrating the Eightfold Path overcomes that.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we know that we're acting in thought, word, and deed within that framework, we're remaining harmless to others and towards ourselves, and there's no I-making in there. But that's recognizing it is part of the whole process. We have to do that first.
Well, I think the place where I've made progress is that in the moment of a situation where, you know, I had a discussion with people Friday night, and the conversation got a little ratcheted up, and I did not. And so I was asked, sort of, come on, you know, like, aren't you in the pool with me here? And I said, I can understand what you're saying. I said, I don't have to inflate my blood pressure. I don't have to do anything. Just, you know, I understand what you're saying, but I'm not going there. And, you know, it was interesting. Bonnie and I have had this conversation where if you've had a part of your behavior where in the past you would have gone there, and then you stop going there, and people get there, and then they're looking for you. And you're not there. And you're not there. And I'm just like, you know, I can tell you in a reasonable fashion how I feel about the situation or whatever. And at one point in the conversation, I said, I'm not going there. I'm not going there. So I'm able to do that, but then it's the second arrow as I sort of regroup and think through thoughts. And, you know, and I've discovered that by not going there, there's no alternative world of judgment that, you know, people really do accept the fact that you're not going to get that ratcheted up about something. But I do it kind of to myself. Well, I should have defended myself here. I should have not stopped talking there or whatever. I'll get through it, but it's been one of those weeks where I've had to put the elephant skin on. Trying to defend myself a little bit.
It's hard not to get caught up in those kind of things, you know, especially on those subtle levels.
Yeah.
And all we can do is to continue to deepen our concentration and mindfulness of, you know, another way of saying the aspects of the Eightfold Path is not right and wrong, but appropriate, and to always understand what is appropriate in this moment. You know, we're not here to be targets for the world, too. You know, when the Buddha was attacked, he defended himself. You know, sometimes it was in a physical way. You know, when, I can't think of his name, was throwing boulders at him, the Buddha didn't stand there and try to catch the boulders, took two steps to the right. It's okay to defend defend ourselves in that way. Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Yeah, it's like knowing to stand out of the way is a way to defend yourself, but something you said earlier, I know when I give to, like, the truth, the benefit, I go, wait, that's really important because I can't keep it in my mind for a second. But, so when the situation like Liz is talking about, when people are trying to pull you back in and trying to defend yourself, trying to be dispassionate, they want you to be passionate, and if you're not, then in some way you don't feel what they feel. I'm trying to be able to acknowledge what I'm feeling, you know, be skillful about it and not give up myself because I'm trying to please others or take care of others. But something you said about recognizing at that point too, which is something that I think I have to walk away from, is about that they need me to do that because they have whatever power thing they, you know, if I cry, then they know, okay, they need me, I'm there. But if I'm, you know, being able to not have to allow myself to become so passionate or emotional, but for me to remember that that's about their suffering.
Yeah.
And it's not about me. Always. In that moment,
yeah.
When I'm trying to be skillful in the Eightfold Path and to not do what I conditionally would have done in the past, right?
Yeah.
Sort of, but that idea that to remember it's not just my suffering that I'm trying to get through, but it's their suffering, so which will give me I'm just thinking out loud, give me more compassion to stand back. And then even though, you know, keeping this all in mind is like, this is a loop that I want to replace with. I keep, we talk about metaphors, and one of the metaphors I've been engaged in is I'm knotting these beating things that I've been working on. And, you know, the harder I pull, the tighter the knot gets.
Yeah.
But if I take my time and I eventually unknot this huge thing, and I realize that just even in my livelihood, and, you know, we all have these knots, and I would like to be able to, one, see the knot, not get knotted, not have to get caught up. I want to stand back from not making the knot bigger or creating. Does that make sense? You know, so that I can be in it, I can be present, but I don't have to
make it worse.
Yeah, or can fabricate these ideas about, like, why people are doing the other things that they're doing. So it's, but that idea of the remembering their suffering.
Yeah, and it what you're talking, what you're describing is it's at that point of recognizing eye-making that you practice restraint, and it's right there. Hello, Diane. Just in time. We'll just start over again. So we'll start with a 20-minute meditation. My talk tonight is on the Brahma Viharas. I'm glad you're here. Jenny.
Just wanted to, Bonnie was kind of, and what Liz said also kind of made me sort of resonated, and when I was trying to think of as few words as possible, the aftermath of moving, sometimes when I move through a situation mindfully and then find myself analyzing the situation after the fact, at the aftermath of coming down, maybe I feel guilty, maybe I feel shameful, maybe I'm whatever. Man, that's just more eye making. That's just the ego trying to reestablish.
And look at the feedback. What you're caught up in is, how am I appearing to the outside world, but also how am I appearing to myself?
And really,
there it is.
Yep.
How do you get out of it? The only way to get out of it is to frame it with the Eightfold Path.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thanks for bringing that up. That's
not
important.
Yeah.
Frank.
I can relate, too, to what they were saying. And, you know, when I'm dealing with employees or a customer or anyone, really, in the family, I have to remember that they're not practicing meditation. They're not practicing mindfulness. They don't have precepts, and they don't understand hindrances to being a good human being, and that they're getting caught up in this riptide currents of their own human emotions. And if I remain with that right view and understand my own involvement in things, it's so much easier for me to take myself out of it, and then I can just see and hear and experience what it is and not really have myself involved in the experience, more like kind of seeing it happen, but I'm not really experiencing it. I'm just watching it.
Yeah. Wow, thank you for saying that. And then we realize how fortunate we are to have what we have, to have the ability to develop the Dhamma and to have it here for us, because not everybody's going to get it. You know, we have a way of taking refuge in the world, in the Buddha, the Dhamma, in this wonderful Sangha. More.
So I know this might not be exactly right, but when the Buddha talks about being mindful of what's occurring inside, being mindful of what's occurring outside, so often in situations when my concentration is good or whatever, I'm trying to recognize what's arising in me and get that, like let go of that and see it, let go of it. So that I can, like what you just said, Frank, to pick up on what's arising in the other person, not from my perspective. And then I might be able to respond, and not even with words, but in a way that diffuses whatever it is. Not like I used to say, oh, it looks like you're upset. Like, that's not always helpful. So, you know, and I realized, say, for a very small example with my mother, I was just thinking about this the other day. We're going to be traveling, and often she gets anxious about something. And
usually about you.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things. But lately when we've been together, I try to recognize her anxiety and do something to that would, like, just create a little bit, like, she'll say, oh, we're going to miss the flight or something, you know, and instead of saying, well, Mom, don't worry, we'll be fine, I'll be like, okay, we'll make a big effort to be there on time. Like, don't laugh at that, that's not funny. But truthfully, like, just hearing what they're saying, and I do this, like, at work, a lot of the families, it's hearing what they're saying and trying to take an appropriate, skillful action and get me out of the way and not tell them they're silly for that way or they're stupid for that, but recognizing they're afraid and what can I do to alleviate their fear right now without work, like without saying, oh, you're afraid, don't be afraid, because that's often what we do to manage our own anxiety.
That doesn't help me feel
right?
Anxious about being on time.
I know. Yeah, but to manage our own anxiety, we want somebody to stop doing whatever it is that they're doing instead of kind of recognizing, oh, they're anxious. And I'll say, oh, can I go get you a chair or something like this? Mm-hmm.
So what you're describing is the an awakened human being, as described by the Buddha, is free of craving and clinging, meaning craving for the continuing establishment of an ego personality and clinging to those views that establish it. And the end result is that we're simply mindfully present with life as life occurs, including other people. The response is always appropriate, and it comes without thinking about what the appropriate response would be. It's just a natural expression of a mind resting in equanimity.
So
you brought up
awakened.
Something.
We're not really all awakened, so we have to kind of just catch it.
Yeah, that's what
know?
I mean. That's where we practice
and
restraint.
It and
so you brought up something else. The Buddha's, talking about the mindset of the Buddha at that point when he first encountered the world and decided he's got to figure it out. He wasn't concerned about answering the great metaphysical questions of who he was, where he came from, where we're going, who made the universe, all that, where we go after death. He was concerned about one thing. Why is life so disappointing? He set out on a search for understanding dukkha. And he figured it out. He awakened to the understanding that craving originates and clinging perpetuates dukkha. Oh, you got cold?
Dissipates the cold air.
And that was really his entire motivation. It was very, very practical. And so his teachings, upon his awakening, were entirely practical. How do we end the constant preoccupation with getting what I want and avoiding what I don't want? Let go of self-referential views.
Move to the other side of the room.
And what's an expression of that? What's an expression of an awakened human being? These four sublime mind states. That's how we know. You know, it's a good when we're in it, and it's also good to know, like more like we've all talked about, when we're not in it. When we're a little bit concerned with the world, when we're reacting to the world. When we're wanting the world to be different or the people in the world to be different, we know that we're stuck in eye-making in that moment. It's not right, it's not wrong, it's not bad, it's not good, it just is. What do? We continue to develop the Eightfold Path so we can continue to recognize this on more and more subtle levels. And what happens when we're awakened? We don't get disappointed anymore. Life is just what it is. Frank.
I was just going to say something about the experience of that stress and anxiety when you catch yourself, when I catch myself being caught up in that self-referential, egotistical mind frame, and now I have to feel the emotion. is acting with a spiritual principle. And that kind of like releases me immediately from the anger that I'm feeling or whatever it is that I'm feeling.
Yeah.
What do you say to yourself? Do you have some sort of...
No, when I acknowledge it, because usually I'm suffering. I can feel the pain, the anger at something, the frustration with somebody, like, you know, being on vacation with my family and being very extremely frustrated, sitting in a restaurant waiting for my daughter, who's only one block around the corner, and she's 20 minutes late, and we want to order our food, to practice that the tolerance, and then that unconditional love when I want to reach out and choke her. And it just releases me from it right away.
Yeah.
And then I can breathe.
She doesn't know how lucky she is that you're doing this practice.
Well, but you're describing, you're recognizing that the reaction in your body and in your mind is telling you that I'm making it. I want something to be different than it is.
But recognizing that sometimes isn't enough for me when I'm really caught up in it. I have to practice something that's an action that releases me from that feeling.
Yep.
And then I could feel the lift. Yeah. I could feel the energy return. I could feel the calmness return, and the, you know, tranquility or whatever you want to call it. Where normally I would have taken a drink, you know, an extra couple shots or something. I would go, waiter, I'll take, you know, a couple more Manhattans or whatever. You know, I don't drink anymore, so I don't have that instant gratification or release from that human emotion. Now I practice a principle, and it's like...
Yeah, and you're describing a well-concentrated mind that knows what to be mindful of in that particular situation. That's the Dhamma. You know?
Whatever I'm feeling, I practice the complete opposite. And I take myself out of it.
Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions or comments tonight? Great class. All right. I don't think I have any announcements tonight. But... Diane, you have.
Where are we? I mean, is this
we're
the end of the
cross
meditation?
Yes.
Center.
Yes. Yes. How's your meditation practice?
Life saving, sanity saving, health saving. I can't begin to describe how. And how it goes into every part of my life. I think for a long time I struggled with the distracting thoughts and bringing my mind back to my breath. And I have learned a couple of, not tricks or anything, I count when I'm out, when I'm off the cushion. When I'm on the cushion, this is, you're going to think I'm stupid, but I just say, you're sitting, just sit, this is it. And that brings me back immediately. And learning some of these things on the cushion to, I'm just now beginning to appreciate what concentration means. I don't think I ever really was able to concentrate before this practice, but when I'm off the cushion and the situation arises that, you know, is disappointing, uncomfortable, or I feel like I want to control it, I remind myself to just sit here, just stand here. And when I'm driving and somebody comes up and, you know, is attached to my bumper, that is one of my, you know, has been or was a pet peeve. I just start counting. One, two, I count up to 110, and then I start all over.
But that makes them really happy.
Well, it makes me
I'm done.
Feel, yeah, I know, but I mean, that was something, and
anyway, I won't go into a story about that. I don't think in my whole life I've ever felt more present. I have a big event coming up for myself, and I notice fear arising, and I say, hello, you know, you're afraid of the unknown. There's absolutely nothing I know about what I'm going into, and the little girl in me wants to say, well, just cancel it and don't do it. Be safe. And I think using that kind of metaphor, the little girl in me that was afraid, what I feel like finally is I'm adult enough, mature enough, or something enough, or loving enough that I can say, we'll get through this. I'm not going to abandon you. And I think that's probably the most precious thing that meditation gives me. I don't abandon. And it's not an eye-making thing, but I just don't, you know, like, I don't abandon myself anymore. And it's a kind of a way to embrace and truly love who I am. And that, you know, I had so much self-loathing for most of my life because I just wasn't making it. And that's why I'm not doing this meditation or this whole practice perfectly, and that's okay. I've finally given myself permission to do it as best I can. And I'm probably using words of eye making and stuff like that, but it's a peace, it's a confidence, it's a self-esteem thing that is humbling, that I don't need to brag about or anything like that. It's just healthy.
Thank you. I'm glad you came tonight. Thank you for bringing the book. Let's finish with meta, as we always do. Find your.
You mentioned announcements. Have you given any thought to our discussion? Or are you going to
read
out that?
I'll talk about that.
Okay.
In the appropriate time. Find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And these are the words of the Buddha from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.